MREA presents the Rise Up Podcast.
And now, a moment to thank our kilowatt sponsor, Northwind Solar. Northwind Solar is Central Wisconsin's premier solar installer, providing high-performance solar power and battery storage systems for home and businesses. They are a worker-owned cooperative with over 100 years of collective experience in renewable energy. Learn more at northwindre.com or visit them at their booth at the 2024 Energy Fair.
Welcome back to the Rise Up Podcast. I am your host, Nick Hyla, and today we are joined by Peter Kildee. Since 1995, Peter has been the executive director of the West Central Wisconsin Community Action Agency, WestCAP. WestCAP works to alleviate poverty through affordable housing development, homelessness intervention, food security, and other sustainable community asset building initiatives. In the past 10 years, WestCAP has ramped up efforts to offer more affordable housing, driven by the urgency to address climate change, impacts on vulnerable populations worldwide. Kildee has championed the integration of energy-efficient practices into the agency's housing projects. Recognized for his outstanding leadership in affordable housing innovation and energy conservation, Peter was honored with the Charles M. Hill Senior Award for Housing Excellence. He's also served on many other boards, including the National Community Action Partnership Board, where now he co-chairs their Climate Working Group Partnership for Climate Resiliency. Is that how you say it, Peter?
Close enough. Climate Resilience, yes. Partnership for Climate Resilience.
And you have served on and still serve on the Wisconsin CAP Association Board. You've been the board chair of Slipstream. You've served on the St. Croix Valley Foundation Board. And you also worked for the Amherst H. Wilder Foundation of St. Paul, Minnesota, where for 10 years you were the operations director of the Wilder Forest, a 1,200-acre conference and education center highlighting the interconnectedness of social and environmental issues. How are you doing today, Peter?
Doing fine. Having listened to all those wonderful achievements, I feel really good.
Well, you have...
I did all that? Well...
Yeah, you did. You have a long and storied career and you are still going. And I'm really excited to talk with you and help you share some of your work more widely. So let's just jump right in. You know, you've obviously had a long and successful career, both in environmental and anti-poverty work. What inspired you to pursue this work and what motivates you today?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question, you know, just trying to figure out how it is we came to value what we value. But I think like most folks, I'm a product of my upbringing and dumb luck to some extent, you know. So my father was a Lutheran minister, born raised in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. He married a farm girl, my mother, from a farm near Elk Mound. And when they decided to start raising a family, and my father was serving little congregations out in the prairie, that their kids should spend the summer on their grandparents' farm. And at that point, he was primarily raising the young stock. He'd given the dairy operation to another kid. And so I spent my summers running around on this farm. He was also a beekeeper. And they were just wonderful summers. And, you know, also an opportunity to learn all kinds of skills. You know, I was driving a John Deere bee tractor when I was 6 years old. And so this experience of interacting with the natural world, and frankly, at that time, they were all organic farms anyway. There weren't any chemicals that I recall at all from what we were doing at that point. So it was all very clean, fun, and wonderful stuff. And then when I became a freshman in high school, I started working for Bible camps in South Dakota. So first on the eastern part of the state, and then 3 summers at a camp in the Black Hills. So again, some really great experiences that combined, you know, an interest in human service and well-being and a lot of great experiences out in the natural world. When I went then to the Wilder Foundation for my first real job while still in college, I started working as a certified preschool teacher. And again, because of that camping background, also they were starting a day camp thing. And that's what I ultimately ended up being part of the planning group, development group, and served, actually ended up being 12 years as operations director of that facility. So all those things were kind of baked in, you know, the connection of the natural world, the value of that, the close relationship with it, and the fact that these were always combined with human service of some kind, you know, and human values. So then when my wife and I decided to start raising our kids, I had a shot at getting one of the other family farms that belonged to an uncle, came out to Wisconsin to sort of have some of that same kind of experience, expecting to commute back to the camp Turns out I landed in the little town of Glenwood City just about the time they were looking for a new executive director, and they did a nationwide search. I walked in from three blocks away and was exactly what they were looking for, you know. And I've been here ever since. Still live on the little farm, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, those are the kind of major drivers, you know, just like I say, a combination of dumb luck and upbringing. And, you know, you value what you understand, experience, and fall in love with. We also homeschooled our kids. And part of our homeschooling is we love to go over for the MREA energy fairs. We went for years. The kids loved it, all those kid activities and everything. So, you know, it's all kind of dovetails, I guess, you know.
Yeah, that's excellent. It sounds like they found the right person because you've been at WestCap for quite a while. And maybe we should just start by talking about CAP agencies in general. They play such a critical role in Wisconsin. So what are CAP agencies? Why are they important? What do they do?
Okay, so CAP agencies actually date back to the Lyndon Johnson War on Poverty, going back in the 60s. In fact, the CAP agencies around the country are celebrating their 60th anniversary this summer. CAP agencies, I think, were one of the best ideas that came out of that whole set of programs. And what they are is they are locally directed programs that are aimed at alleviating poverty, reducing poverty when you can, in whatever locale that they start with. So unlike most federal programs that are administered from, you know, Washington or that kind of thing, these were all designed from the very beginning to be locally controlled. So our boards are made up of one-third local public officials, one-third community organizations, and one-third actually low-income people elected by other low-income people. So they're very much grounded in the community. And so, you know, we were actually the second CAP formed in the state of Wisconsin. So now there are 16 CAPs in Wisconsin. There's just over 1,000 nationwide. We're in 99% of the counties of the country. And we've been here through thick and thin and all kinds of political and other threats and whatnot, and still going strong. And, you know, we are sort of able to do whatever we feel is appropriate to help low-income people in our area. So we have a great latitude for creativity, for putting programs together and doing all kinds of things. And our agency last year, directly or indirectly, helped 38,000 people.
Yeah, so what are some of the programs and services that you currently provide?
Well, there's sort of, you know, three clusters is the way I look at it. One is we do things around housing, okay? So we run this large weatherization program. Well, in fact, most of our work is somehow related to housing, but we were, interestingly enough, the first federally funded weatherization program in the country, and now there are about 900. And I've always kind of had that, you know, innovation approach, which I'll get back to. So we, you know, weatherize homes. We provide energy assistance through the, you know, Wisconsin Home Energy Assistance Program. We do a lot of work around homeless intervention. And there's several different programs that we operate in there. But again, it's about a third of our agency-wide activities. We run a skills program for helping people get the skills they need for literacy and other opportunities in the workforce, low-income folks. We have a big nursing component of that. We also operate the federal food assistance programs in our part of the country. We work with about 42 different outlets where we're providing core stuff, plus we have our own food pantry. We have been very involved in the local farmers market. We spun that off as an independent thing this year. We'd like to start a few more of those around. Yeah, so we cover that gambit, and then we've long done affordable housing development. We became what's technically called a CHOTO, that's a community housing development organization, nonprofit. Had that status, just got that when I started here 30 years ago, and we're just beginning our first project. Since then, under our own work, we've developed about 360 units, and then we've also done another 600 or so. It keeps changing with a private developer, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But going back to some of that earlier work, again, coming into this thing with my background connecting environmental and social concerns, I was sort of pre-wired for climate change and all those kind of things. And you know, frankly, already came a little bit ahead of the field here. You know, most folks don't come out of an environmental background into this work. So we were doing deep retrofits on houses, 15 years ago. 12 years ago, we built a net zero new house that we still have as rental property. It's still working great in Menominee. We did a dozen other different kinds of buildings. We also built a student dormitory, 96-bed for the Rice Lake, UW-Barron, and Tech School campus. And again, going back in 2007, 2008, it was geothermal heating and cooling for that. We put, 24 vertical wells under the parking lot. And so we have all this experience with it. And then, I'll probably get into this more a little bit later, but it was that experience that got the for-profit investors and whatnot to take a chance with us on doing some really innovative things in new affordable housing development. So that's kind of winding through that.
And maybe we'll get to that right away because, first I just want to recognize that all of the diverse services that you're providing to low income and unhoused people in through WestCap, but just the sheer amount of work that CAP puts into anti-poverty efforts and all of your efforts. And many people don't recognize that how much better you make people's lives and how much community improvement comes from your work. As you mentioned, your work in the environment prior has really led to a lot of innovations coming out of WestCap. And so my next question, I'll boot this up to you. You've done a lot, you explained a lot, but right now, what is WestCap working on today that has you excited?
A lot of it has me excited. One thing in particular, going back to this affordable housing development, we are on track to complete let me back up just a little bit. Project that we did in 2021 and in 2022 sort of got the top national award for green and healthy housing. It's called Epson Award. It comes out of the whole tax credit world and big deal out in DC with all kinds of, important people. And we have continued to do that work. A very similar project in New Richmond. We're completing one in Eau Claire that's a 60 unit, mostly geothermal and PV based, again, generating about 70% of its own energy on site renewably. And then we are proceeding on what we hope to be a net zero affordable housing project, working population housing and 80% low income and our county median income and some very affordable units that would be close to net zero in Ellsworth, workforce housing, that kind of thing. So I'm very involved in that. I take the lead on that in our organization and certainly excited about that. But I also have to say, the things that we're doing in helping people get their job skills in place, the literacy and skills work is really excellent. Doing all kinds of creative programs around homeless interventions, that's exceptional. We've always also had a real leader in our food pantry and food distribution program. We use get fresh produce from local producers and do things beyond just the commodity program and whatnot. The energy assistance thing in our particular agency, we were doing 2 counties 3 years ago. Now we're doing 9. it's hard to say to break down, which of these are excited about. I'm excited about just the whole darn thing. I really am.
That's why you're still there, apparently.
That's why I'm still here. And I, I can't imagine doing, things that are better with the, to be able to make a decent living by helping the world be a better place. That to me is just the perfect thing. It's like, what luck. And I always feel fortunate.
Well, let's dig in a bit on, you do so much stuff, but let's dig in a bit on the weatherization assistance program. And then also energy assistance and maybe the relationship for the two. But starting with the weatherization assistance program, what is it? And if I'm a person, a low-income person that is struggling to pay energy bills, how does it help?
First of all, just a little history of that program. The weatherization program was started in 1976. And this was during the first oil crisis and the embargo and all that kind of stuff. And at that point, again, what we're seeing is, the energy costs were also really going up. So the program was created primarily as a way of making the buildings that low-income people were living in use less energy. And it was all around cost savings. What can we do to lower the energy bills of this population? And it's always been absolutely one of the best programs, frankly, that I can think out there, because everybody comes out a winner. You know, people that live there, you know, we've been averaging, you know, maybe a 30% reduction in, you know, energy costs across the board. It varies a little bit. It also, you know, we employ large weatherization staff workforce doing this good work that's part of economic development in our area. Lowers, you know, some of the risk from utility providers. You know, they have less of that to carry. We also often combine this with energy assistance, you know, which is a whole nother program. But that experience being inside all of these houses, right, just gives us a great working knowledge of how the houses work, how they don't work, what the deficiencies are. There are issues with the program, as there are with many. One of the biggest ones is that if a house doesn't have certain needs met, like a good roof and whatnot, they've generally been deferred because we, you know, you can't get your insulation get wet and all that kind of stuff. It's considered not ready. And we've also been very serious about, you know, trying to address that, getting some funds in to do, you know, preparation for the house. So it is, more houses are eligible. We do some of that work. A lot more needs to be done there in policy, but we, at least the federal government has started setting aside some weatherization readiness funds for the first time in many years. So we're also engaged in that level. I've been very involved in our national efforts to influence the program, you know, through my service on that national board, also with our national lobbyist group. So we're able to, again, do that great thing, which is to take on the ground real experience. We know exactly what this, how this stuff works, and translate that into policy work and improvement of the program nationally. So it does tend to be, fortunately, one of the more non-controversial programs in Congress. Has always had good bipartisan support, still does. Came through with a little bit of an increase, again, and through all the big budget crunches that come out here and stuff. So very appreciative of the fact that it is also widely recognized for its contribution. Like, everybody comes out a winner. Everybody with this program, you know.
You know, one of the challenges of the program is just that it's not enough funding to meet the need. Like, not only is there a third project, right? But you always, at least in our CAP agency and others I've talked, there's always a waiting list. And the Inflation Reduction Act increased some of the budget for the weatherization assistance program. Do you know what that's going to look like for like West CAP?
To be honest, I don't.
My expectation is that there will be more funding, but I don't know the level, if it's going to meet the level of need that you have.
Yeah, and I have to say, it is a bit of a challenge these days because, you know, we're all busy doing all kinds of things and trying to keep track of, you know, what comes out of the Inflation Reduction Act, what comes out of the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, what comes out of the ARPA, what, you know, and who's administering it, how do you get access to it and everything. That could be a full-time job, just trying to track all that stuff. It is starting to settle out a little bit and getting some more guidance on it, but I don't have a real good handle on where, how it... Well, let's put it, what I usually say is how we get our mitts on the money.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we do know is now is a good time for a low to moderate income family to inquire about weatherization assistance. Maybe just walk us through the process of how this happens for a home. How does the weatherization assistance program work?
Well, first of all, the way it works in Wisconsin is if you apply for energy assistance, okay, through the Wisconsin, you know, Energy Assistance, Home Energy Assistance Program, or WEAP, that makes you sort of automatically eligible for consideration in the weatherization program. So in terms of, you know, applying for it or all that kind of stuff, we get the list. We know exactly who our area is, that larger population. Within that, then you look at, you know, has that home been weatherized, you know, and if it has been weatherized within the last, I think it's 10 years at this point, then we aren't able to go back until, you know, during the life of the measures. The other issue that I raised, you know, if everything else has come together on it, we'll send out an auditor, and the auditor will do a very thorough computerized inspection, blower door tests, all that kind of stuff. It's very technical and been done for many years, very reliable, infrared cameras to check heat loss and all that kind of stuff. But again, if the home has, you know, a really bad foundation or the roof leaks, all that kind of stuff, and things that aren't covered by the program, then we have to defer it. or, you know, sometimes people move. There's all kinds of things, you know, so you go through that and then you get on the list and we are pretty much able to, you know, like last year we brotherized, or in 2022 is 261 houses, you know. I mean, we really get out there and take a whack at it. So, and that's, you know, it's pretty much expend the contract. You know, we spend all the money we've got to do this thing. And there's a lot of rules within that, you know. But at the end of the day, again, in our whole part of the country, 261 houses. How many houses do you think could benefit from weatherization? Well, you know, 50 times that, right? I mean, it's just like, you know. So I was a little bit of frustration, but very pleased again with what we are able to do.
Yeah. And with the weatherization assistance program, you know, you're addressing this older housing stock, you know, that needs it. And it also reduces low-income reliance on energy assistance, which that program just pays electricity bills, right? Just in lieu of the customer paying, pays the utility to kind of avoid utility shutoffs. And how many people are served by that program in your area a year, and how does that program work?
Well, energy assistance in our last year was close to 9,000 households. That's a big deal. You know, it doesn't cover all the energy costs. You know, they set an amount and it's assistance. It doesn't, you know, but not. We do have protections in the state and shut off in, you know, during certain periods and everything, but it doesn't pay the whole bill. And the money does go directly to the utilities. Again, it's a very important program, you know, provides a huge amount of assistance and whatnot, but it also has its limitations, right? Addresses the symptom to some extent. Yeah. And, you know, the problem is huge, you know, with the way our economic system works. You know, how far do you want to tackle that? But
no. Well, it's a good time to talk about this because in Wisconsin, we have a utility shutoff moratorium that actually ends in April. It just ended. And that means that now the utilities can, for people who can't pay, can shut off power, which is debilitating, as you can imagine, in modern life to a low-income family. And so the energy assistance and weatherization assistance program ostensibly are supposed to help with that. But like you said, poverty is a growing concern in the U.S., and these programs could use much more funding, of course. But you're not only addressing, you know, the other challenge here is we're building new stuff. And the last thing we want to do is build new stuff that uses a lot of energy, is inefficient, and is uncomfortable to live in. And that has been, it seems to me, one of the things that it has given you and WestCap some, and your partners, some national recognition, which you've talked about. And so talk to us a little bit about your approach to affordable housing and this high energy efficient affordable housing. What have been some of the major successes and what are the challenges?
Well, this has been kind of an interesting process. You know, we used to do all of our own housing development in-house, and that's a kind of a risky operation. So we did good projects. They all still exist. They're meeting their need and all that kind of stuff. But there was a period there where, you know, things went south for a while, and I realized that it's way too much risk, you know, to risk all the other programs that we operate, you know, for that one service. So we stopped that about 12 years ago. And then 10 years ago, I got contacted by a private developer and, you know, basically worked out very quickly a relationship in terms of a split for the developer fees, in terms of our cooperation, help, and assistance. You know, we get a small part of that for sure, but also that they would take the risk, you know, and found a partner who was very willing to do that. Good reputation, doing very, you know, exceeding building codes already in energy efficiency. Anyway, did a couple of projects together. And then, frankly, I just, looking at the way things are unfolding in the world, I told them we got to do better. No, I said, no one else is doing this right. And, you know, I think it is possible. And again, this goes back to what I was saying earlier. I don't know how much you know about the tax credit world. I don't want to get into that too far, but, you know, for-profit companies can purchase tax credits. A certain amount are allocated to each state by the IRS, and realize the benefit of those credits over 10 years in projects that need another 5 years of compliance in order for that to work. But it's a really important funding source. And we were able to persuade an aggregator of these kind of funds that does this, you know, nationwide, to essentially take a chance on a greater upfront investment in renewable energy and meeting its own energy supply needs, with a trade-off of, you know, project stability and savings down the road. Okay. And again, because of our agency's experience with this stuff, going back 15 years ago, that we actually had worked with heat pumps for many years, we'd seen the benefits, we knew what we were talking about, they sort of took a chance with us. And the developers, the Girard Corporation, went way, you know, beyond my experience. I thought I knew a lot about this stuff, but, you know, in terms of technologies and all that, they completely got it. So we were able to do this project in River Falls, the 1300 project, designed to produce, you know, initially 70% of its energy on site in a building inside an infill property in River Falls, right on the main street and all that kind of stuff. And that, the fact that that worked, even and built through COVID and everything, it was a wild deal. But within, you know, a couple of years, it was very obvious that, you know, this whole thing made sense. And again, same old story, everybody comes out a winner, you know, the people that live there don't have energy bills. They have no, there's one energy meter for the entire building that's paid by us as owners. They don't have any energy bills along with that. We've been able in this very rapidly rising rent environment to keep rents exactly the same for people that moved in there as they were 3 years ago. And the residents get that completely, you know. So between that and the fact, again, serving as I was on the national board of the Community Action World, I was also very close to the national leadership in HHS, Office of Community Services, whatnot, that, you know, supports CAP agencies. And knowing what we had done, they picked our agency to be their big Earth Day thing a year ago, and sent out this professional film crew. We did a, you know, a couple of days making a 4-minute video, you know, about 1300 and everything. And that's almost kind of went viral. I mean, that's really was, they did a fabulous job on it. And I still love that thing. So that sort of cult, you know, catapulted our visibility up there all over the country. And also because the project's working, you know, it, you know, we had a terrible solar year that you're following, I'm sure you're aware of it, between, you know, slush, ice, freezing all over the panels, all that kind of time. It wasn't so hot. This last year, we hit that 70% again, just completely. And we've learned a lot. You know, we're doing things, you know, again, replicating a big part of this so far in three projects that are done, are very close to done. And then we've got three more that have been approved most recently in just the last couple of weeks, a 38 unit that we'll be doing in Hudson. And again, that'll be, you know, we're shooting for about that 70% on-site generation and might even be able to improve that.
So if you can prove with these developments, which you have, that it kind of de-risks the project, it, the upfront costs pay for themselves over time, and that these organizations that fund the projects are supportive, why wouldn't anybody else do it?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, part of what, when I talked to our private developer partner, you know, and I like these guys a lot, I said, Paul, what we do in this project isn't going to make a hill of beans the difference in the climate issue. What we need to do is transform the industry. We have to do this in a way that everybody else is going to want to do it and not rely on them doing it because they, you know, love poor people and baby polar bears. You know, it's going to have to be, you know, it's going to have to work for them in every dimension. You know, I'm very pleased to say that we've made some progress in that area. You know, the scoring in this state around, you know, the who gets these tax credit funds, and it's highly competitive. You know, if you don't get those, it's very hard to do this stuff. They're shifting that, you know, to allow more point value to renewable energy systems and energy conservation. I was at the conference where they announced that change, and on the slide where they announced it, it was a picture of the roof of 1300. You know, so that was the moment I knew we had scored. You know, I was like, yes. You know, move the needle. We actually moved the needle. You know, and that's, you know, so yeah, you were asking before what I get excited about. You're watching excitement right here.
Well, it's interesting. You're moving the needle in another regard also, which is one of the limitations for solar development on multifamily housing projects is the ability to spread the benefits of that solar to the individual tenants, because there's basically a rule that prevents that distribution of benefits on multiple meters for these single multifamily projects. But it seems like, because of the successes you've had, that the commission might take this up and might make a change. You want to talk about that?
That's a very complex world of, I'm learning a little bit more about it. I don't consider myself an expert in that area. It's complicated. So we have been able to get the waivers for the individual meters and individual apartment buildings in two munis, okay, where we've operated. The project in Eau Claire is in Xcel's territory, and we appealed that, and they denied it. And that went all the way up through the Public Service Commission and lost in the final round of that as well. Now, there are folks still interested in challenging that. And, part of what I'm trying to do is, again, take a slightly different approach. Is, okay, well, how do you make this work for Xcel? Or any investor-owned utility, and you're seeing rate increases that are, quite dramatic all over the state and this kind of thing. It's a serious issue, but some of the things coming down the pike in terms of the known phenomenal expansion of energy requirements from AI, things that are popping up all over the place, folks are going to be struggling anyway for all kinds of reasons, while also trying to meet climate targets and commitments and other requirements. So they're also in a very tough spot. And I want to be very sympathetic to that.
Yeah, the challenge, of course, is, and the importance of your work is that, we exist in this energy system that has some perverse incentives, right? That investor-owned utility, their investors are paid to build things. They get paid from capital expenditures. They build something, their investors make a protected rate of return. But the way that gets paid back is through electricity rates. And so the incentive for the utility isn't towards efficiency. And your work in particular becomes critical, because the last place that we want increasing energy costs is on people who can least afford them. That's a risk to the whole system. It's a risk to people. And it's antithetical to your mission. But it's a very sympathetic cause, this idea. And just to be clear, the idea that you can leverage a national funding agency that benefits from tax credits that ostensibly are supposed to serve low-income households, and you can help work with them to make solar affordable and deliver it to housing development, but not directly deliver it to bill savings on the residents. That's the thing. That's where the rubber meets the road, right? If you can directly reduce everybody's electricity bill, and there's one little rule there, that the commission, and we have three new commissioners, they still have that new commissioner smell. So it's possible. So anyway, I'm only, I can't see the future. We went in front of the commission and lost recently on third-party ownership of solar. Not lost, they just refused to make a ruling. So what do I know? But I just want to recognize that it could be very much again that you see the roof of 1300 on some press release for changing a rule.
Well, and let me be clear, even if you have the meter, you can still greatly reduce the energy burden beyond, that they're holding anyway. And again, I keep looking for sort of win-wins around for this in all of these issues. But so, yeah, the meter charge is, not only present, but if you're trying to do building-wide systems, and in 1300, because we had the single meter, we were able to use building-wide air source heat pumps. We were used variable flow refrigerant so we can move the energy where it needs to be most efficiently. Plus, we did all kinds of other things in terms of super insulation and everything, and that really works very well. Within the individual meter thing, there are ways around. There are some systems that you can put on a building-wide things as long as everybody has an account. We think ultimately that is an unnecessary expense. And, Wisconsin also has fairly perverse legislation around how big of a unit you can have of electricity before, for example, we have the sort of 1 kilowatt limit to an array if you're doing net metering. And if it gets beyond that, then, you know, the electricity is bought by the investor-owned utility at, you know, under 3 cents a kilowatt. They turn around and send it back, sell it back to you at 15. That doesn't seem like a really good deal to us, right? So, you know, we're very interested in trying to make that whole thing work better.
Well, we all have these new bedfellows now, don't we? That's your long experience has helped you manage this kind of like affordable housing and energy world. And this is the kind of stuff that gets us excited, is when clean energy projects used to be solar, like you were at the energy fair, you know, the first energy fair 34 years ago, there was a vendor selling solar and it was $80 per watt that time. Flash forward to today, you're under $3 a watt for a residential system and closer to $1.25 a watt for utility scale. And so at this, with this opportunity, the idea of providing long-term energy bill reduction, sustainability, producing energy where it's needed, delivering the benefits to the people that need it most, it's really exciting. And so that's one of the real reasons I was very happy to talk with you today, because you're pioneering these energy efficiency weatherization, like marrying all these different programs from the federal government to tie this in a nice little bowl for your community. And so when you look at the future of some of these affordable housing developments, are you seeing more interest? Is this project developing in a way that you think is providing more opportunity?
Yeah, I think it's been quite remarkable, in fact. You know, and again, there is something in the human psyche. We are social animals. We learn from each other's experience. There's a huge difference between words and actions in terms of its motivational stuff. And there was, you know, endless verbiage around the need to do this kind of thing forever until, you know, at 1300, we pushed the envelope. We challenged the system and made it work. And once we had that in place, you know, I'm bringing groups through that project regularly, and, you know, being invited to speak to housing summits and development groups and environmental conferences, just on and on and on, you know, with a story of, yeah, you can do this. You know, it's like we're primates, we imitate. You know, these bunch of primates were able to put this thing up and make it work, and the numbers work, and the residents are happy, and everybody's a beneficiary, you know, this kind of stuff. Once they see it, yeah, I mean, you know, we got picked by the state to bring their new, you know, division head for Energy Plus programs up here just last week, you know, to see an agency that could, you know, was doing this stuff right and everything. And we're very pleased about that, but mostly because of exactly what you're talking about, you know, showing that it can work. And, you know, nobody's lost anything out of the deal, right? You know, delighted, you know, they got affordable housing, workforce housing right downtown where they need it. It's a walkable kind of thing. You know, they put us up a bus stop. I love that. There are no buses in River Falls. We still got a couple of points for it. There will be buses. That's what we're told. But they're not yet. But we got a great bus stop right in front of the place. Lowered the speed limit 10 miles an hour on an important road just to make this, to support this, you know. So again, you know, this same approach of trying to make, okay, let's, you know, I don't want this, any of these things to be looked at as a, hey, we're going to take this from you and give it to those guys, right? You know, that the benefit, and I really believe the benefit is there, is a benefit to everybody. You know, it's the future we all share. The people that are living there. It's, you know, less, you know, burden on whoever's generating that energy, you know, in terms of peak and all that kind of stuff. So emphasizing that kind of an element to it, as opposed to we're going to fight you and win or lose, is just, I think, a much more productive way to go at this. And that's, it's a little less defined sometimes.
I don't give this away very often, but you've convinced me with your long and successful career as a humanist and an environmentalist. I'm giving you the magic wand. This is the magic. You look like you could use a magic wand also. You could look trustworthy with a magic wand. I'm giving you a magic wand, and you can wave it and wish anything for WestCap to greatly impact your work. How would you use this magic wand? What do you need? What more do we need?
I think, you know, I mean, it sounds way too simplistic, but what I would love to see is that, you know, you can earn an experience that gets you discretionary money, just said, okay, you guys have proven that you can do good things with money and everything. The bureaucratic requirements of all the programs we run suck up so much time and energy. And we know and can demonstrate now that we know what to do with the money. And, you know, to be able to have larger amounts of discretionary money so we're not constantly, you know, trying to field the requirements of 55 different programs, just say, okay, you know, you've demonstrated or can you know, give people a chance to demonstrate that, you know, you would use this kind of thing constructively. The creativity we can get out of that, or some activities that don't quite work because they're not, you know, they don't pay for the staff to run them. It's just for direction, all kinds of those kind of stuff. We could make all those things work with just a little bit of that.
Every community service program director in the country is wishing they had your magic wand right now. That's a that is a great magic wand response.
Oh, a good friend of mine, you know, runs a big urban camp, Mark Perry, down in Beloit, you know, and he's so eloquent about this. So he says, you don't have to tell me what to do with the money. I know exactly what to do with the money. I know more about what to do with the money in Beloit than any other human on the planet. He says, he's right. He and I are actually talking about trying to do a workshop at the national conference this year, which I'm calling City Mouse and Country Mouse, Start Adapting to Climate Change. So he's, you know, urban from the get-go his whole life, you know, in that kind of setting. They're doing great stuff down there. And, you know, I'm a farm kid, right? And the way we can work together in a relationship on these things, I think could be really exciting. So we'll see if that happens. But
well, good. I might travel out to see that one. One last question for you. I interact with a lot of young people. I teach a course over at the local college on energy policy. So college kids, we got a group of high school kids here today. And what I see in the younger generation is some, well, just generally, I guess generally too, and they're impacted by it, is some pessimism and some negativity. And so I want to ask you, after having such a long career and still being passionate about your job and still doing good stuff, what advice would you give to young people to get them more motivated and excited?
I'll come at that in a slightly different angle. I give some presentations around and have a few times, and the framing I use is the best of all possible futures. It's not a doomer message, but it's also built around the fact that almost everything that has given humans meaning and purpose and value in their lives over our 300,000 years on the planet have been activities that don't require burning fossil fuels, you know, that don't require causing climate change, that aren't piling up more cheap crap and calling this a better life. You know what I'm saying? That, you know, its relationship to other humans, to family, to place, a sense of agency in your interactions with those places, all that kind of stuff. So much of what's gone on in the environmental community, which I think is a failure, and in so many other parts of this, is, you know, all the things you have to give up and all you have to, you know, because of, you know, what's going on with climate or because of this kind of thing. And the pessimism is around all, you know, these things we're going to lose, you know, or all that kind of stuff. At least that's a part of it. But to turn that around and say, you know, there are different ways of thinking about and behaving on the planet. You know, let's look a little bit more to, you know, the people that were living here when the first boats came over from Europe, who would happen to be around here relatively happily for 10,000 years without screwing the place up, or 20,000, you know. So, and some of those orientations towards how to exist on the planet are extremely meaningful and rich and important. And so, you know, part of what we need to do is shed the thing the flat screen's been telling us for 75 years, which is to be happy, you have to have this, right? And if you had this, you would be more popular, and that you'd be more successful, and this, you know, and that kind of stuff. That whole orientation is going to have to slide. The meaning that comes out of relationship, sense of agency, connection to place, those will be there. They can be there. Focus on more on that kind of stuff is the what I would say is some kind of antidote to pessimism. I got three daughters, you know, that I'm very close to, and two or three of them want to spend their lives on the little organic farm around that kind of stuff. Okay. You know, I couldn't be happier, But, you know, it's not going to be, you know, a mansion in suburbia, I can guarantee you.
Thank you, Peter. I think we'll leave it with that wonderful message. We appreciate your time today. Keep up the good work.
Well, I very much appreciate the opportunity. And, you know, if I can do anything else for you, give me a holler.
The Rise Up Podcast, Season 5, Episode 3, West Cap Weatherization Assistance Program in Wisconsin. Special thanks to our guest, Peter Kildee, hosted by Nick Hyla and produced by Kyle Galloway. Made possible with support from the Sally Need Hands Foundation.